Chapter 8. Nance had become almost sympathetic. If this day week here, at the same hour, will suit Mr. Vendale and yourself, I will enter in my diary that I attend you accordingly. The appointment was made, and in due sequence, kept. The will was formally signed, sealed, delivered, and witnessed, and was carried off by Mr. Bintrey for safe storage among the papers of his clients, ranged in their respective iron boxes, with their respective owners' names outside, on iron tiers in his consulting room, as if that legal sanctuary were a condensed family vault of clients. With more heart than he had lately had for former subjects of interest, Wilding then set about completing his patriarchal establishment, being much assisted, not only by Mrs. Goldstraw, but by Vendale too, who, perhaps, had in his mind the giving of an Ebenezer dinner as soon as possible. Anyhow, the establishment being reported in sound working order, the Ebenezers, guardian, and ward, were asked to dinner, and Madame Dor was included in the invitation. If Vendale had been over head and ears in love before, a phrase not to be taken as implying the faintest doubt about it, this dinner plunged him down in love 10,000 fathoms deep. Yet, for the life of him, he could not get one word alone with charming Marguerite. So surely as a blessed moment seemed to come, Ebenezer, in his filmy state, would stand at Vendale's elbow, or the broad back of Madame Dor would appear before his eyes. That speechless matron was never seen in a front view, from the moment of her arrival to that of her departure except at dinner. And from the instant of her retirement to the drawing room, after a hearty participation in that meal, she turned her face to the wall again. Yet, through 4 or 5 delightful though distracting hours, Marguerite was to be seen, Marguerite was to be heard, Marguerite was to be occasionally touched. When they made the round of the old dark cellars, Vendale led her by the hand. When she sang to him in the lighted room at night, Vendale, standing by her, held her relinquished gloves, and would have bartered against them every drop of the 45-year-old, though it had been 45 times 45 years old, and its net price 45 times 45 pounds per dozen. And still, when she was gone, and a great gap of an extinguisher was clapped on Cripple Corner, he tormented himself by wondering, did she think that he admired her? Did she think that he adored her? Did she suspect that she had won him, heart and soul? Did she care to think at all about it? And so, did she and didn't she, up and down the gamut, and above the line, and below the line, dear, dear. Poor restless heart of humanity. To think that the men who were mummies thousands of years ago, did the same, and ever found the secret, how to be quiet after it. What do you think, George? Wilding asked him next day, of Mr. Ebenezer. I won't ask you, what do you think of Miss Ebenezer?
I don't know, said Vendale, and I never did know, what to think of him.
He is well informed and clever, said Wilding. Certainly clever. A good musician. He had played very well, and sung very well, overnight.
Unquestionably a good musician.
And talks well.
Yes, said George Vendale, ruminating, and talks well.
Do you know, Wilding, it oddly occurs to me, as I think about him, that he doesn't keep silence well.
How do you mean?
He is not obtrusively talkative.
No, and I don't mean that. But when he is silent, you can hardly help vaguely, though perhaps most unjustly, mistrusting him. Take people whom you know and like. Take anyone you know and like.
Soon done, my good fellow, said Wilding. I take you.
I didn't bargain for that, or foresee it, returned Vendale, laughing.
However, take me.
Reflect for a moment.
Is your approving knowledge of my interesting face mainly founded, however various the momentary expressions it may include, on my face when I am silent?
I think it is, said Wilding.
I think so too.
Now, you see, when Ebenezer speaks in other words, when he is allowed to explain himself away he comes out right enough, but when he has not the opportunity of explaining himself away, he comes out rather wrong. Therefore it is that I say he does not keep silence well. And passing hastily in review such faces as I know and don't trust, I am inclined to think, now I give my mind to it, that none of them keep silence well. This proposition in physiognomy being new to Wilding, he was at first slow to admit it, until asking himself the question whether Mrs. Goldstraw kept silence well, and remembering that her face in repose decidedly invited trustfulness, he was as glad as men usually are to believe what they desire to believe. But, as he was very slow to regain his spirits or his health, his partner, as another means of setting him up, and perhaps also with contingent abenries or views, reminded him of those musical schemes of his in connection with his family, and how a singing class was to be formed in the house, and a choir in a neighboring church. The class was established speedily, and two or three of the people, having already some musical knowledge, and singing tolerably, the choir soon followed. The latter was led, and chiefly taught, by Wilding himself, who had hopes of converting his dependents into so many foundlings, in respect of their capacity to sing sacred choruses. Now, the Abenreezers being skilled musicians, it was easily brought to pass that they should be asked to join these musical unions, guardian and ward consenting, or guardian consenting for both. It was necessarily brought to pass that Vendale's life became a life of absolute thraldom and enchantment. For, in the moldy Christopher Wren church on Sundays, with its dearly beloved brethren assembled and met together, 25 strong, was not that her voice, that shot like light into the darkest places, thrilling the walls and pillars, as though they were pieces of his heart? What time, too, Madame Dor in a corner of the high pew, turning her back upon everybody and everything, could not fail to be ritualistically right at some moment of the service, like the man whom the doctors recommended to get drunk once a month, and who, that he might not overlook it, got drunk every day. But, even though seraphic Sundays were surpassed by the Wednesday concerts established for the patriarchal family, at those concerts she would sit down to the piano and sing them, in her own tongue, songs of her own land, songs calling from the mountaintops to Vendale, rise above the groveling level country, come far away from the crowd, pursue me as I mount higher, 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 melting into the azure distance, rise to my supremest height of all, and love me here. Then would the pretty bodice, the clocked stocking, and the silver buckled shoe be, like the broad forehead and the bright eyes, fraught with the spring of a very chamois, until the strain was over. Not even over Vendale himself did these songs of hers cast a more potent spell than over Joey Ladle in his different way. Steadily refusing to muddle the harmony, by taking any share in it, and evincing the supremest contempt for scales, and such like rudiments of music which, indeed, seldom captivate mere listeners, Joey did at first give up the whole business for a bad job, and the whole of the performers for a set of howling dervishes. But, descrying traces of unmuddled harmony in a part song one day, he gave his two undercellarmen faint hopes of getting on towards something in course of time. An anthem of Handel's led to further encouragement from him, though he objected that that great musician must have been down in some of them foreign cellars pretty much, for to go and say the same thing so many times over, which, took it in how you might, he considered a certain sign of your having took it in somehow. On a third occasion, the public appearance of Mr. Jarvis with a flute, and of an odd man with a violin, and the performance of a duet by the two, did so astonish him that, solely of his own impulse and motion, he became inspired with the words, encore, repeatedly pronouncing them, as if calling in a familiar manner for some lady who had distinguished herself in the orchestra. But this was his final testimony to the merits of his mates, for, the instrumental duet being performed at the first Wednesday concert, and being presently followed by the voice of Margarita Benreezer, he sat with his mouth wide open, entranced, until she had finished. when, rising in his place with much solemnity, and prefacing what he was about to say with a bow, that specially included Mr. Wilding in it, he delivered himself of the gratifying sentiment, "Arter that, ye may all on ye get to bed," and ever afterwards declined to render homage in any other words to the musical powers of the family. Thus began a separate personal acquaintance between Margarita Benreiser and Joey Ladle. She laughed so heartily at his compliment, and yet was so abashed by it, that Joey made bold to say to her, after the concert was over, he hoped he wasn't so muddled in his head, as to have took a liberty? She made him a gracious reply, and Joey ducked in return. "You'll change the luck time about, miss," said Joey, ducking again. "It's such as you in the place, that can bring round the luck of the place."
"Can I?
Round the luck?" she answered, in her pretty English, and with a pretty wonder. "I fear I do not understand. I am so stupid." "Young Master Wilding, miss," Joey explained confidentially, though not much to her enlightenment, "changed the luck, afore he took in young Master George. So I say, and so they'll find. Lord! Only come into the place, and sing over the luck a few times, miss, and it won't be able to help itself." With this, and with a whole brood of ducks, Joey backed out of the presence. But Joey being a privileged person, and even an involuntary conquest being pleasant to youth and beauty, Marguerite merrily looked out for him next time. "Where is my Mr. Joey, please?" she asked Vendale. So Joey was produced, and shaken hands with, and that became an institution. Another institution arose in this wise. Joey was a little hard of hearing. He himself said it was vapors, and perhaps it might have been, but whatever the cause of the effect, there the effect was, upon him. On this first occasion he had been seen to sidle along the wall, with his left hand to his left ear, until he had sidled himself into a seat pretty near the singer, in which place and position he had remained, until addressing to his friends the amateurs the compliment before mentioned. It was observed on the following Wednesday, that Joey's action as a pecking machine was impaired at dinner, and it was rumored about the table, that this was explainable by his high-strung expectations of Miss Benreiser's singing, and his fears of not getting a place, where he could hear every note and syllable. The rumor reaching Wilding's ears, he in his good nature called Joey to the front at night before Marguerite began. Thus the institution came into being that on succeeding nights, Marguerite, running her hands over the keys before singing, always said to Vendale, "Where is my Mr. Joey, please?" And that Vendale always brought him forth, and stationed him nearby. That he should then, when all eyes were upon him, express in his face the utmost contempt for the exertions of his friends and confidence in Marguerite alone, whom he would stand contemplating, not unlike the rhinoceros out of the spelling book, tamed and on his hind legs, was a part of the institution. Also that when he remained after the singing in his most ecstatic state, some bold spirit from the back should say, "What do you think of it, Joey?" And he should be goaded to reply, as having that instant conceived the retort, "Arter that ye may all on ye get to bed." These were other parts of the institution. But, the simple pleasures and small jests of Cripple Corner, were not destined to have a long life. Underlying them from the first, was a serious matter, which every member of the patriarchal family knew of, but which, by tacit agreement, all forbore to speak of. Mr. Wilding's health was in a bad way. He might have overcome the shock he had sustained in the one great affection of his life, or he might have overcome his consciousness of being in the enjoyment of another man's property, but the two together were too much for him. A man haunted by twin ghosts, he became deeply depressed. The inseparable specter sat at the board with him, ate from his platter, drank from his cup, and stood by his bedside at night. When he recalled his supposed mother's love, he felt as though he had stolen it. When he rallied a little under the respect and attachment of his dependents, he felt as though he were even fraudulent in making them happy, for that should have been the unknown man's duty and gratification. Gradually, under the pressure of his brooding mind, his body stooped, his step lost its elasticity, his eyes were seldom lifted from the ground. He knew he could not help the deplorable mistake that had been made, but he knew he could not mend it. For the days and weeks went by, and no one claimed his name or his possessions. And now there began to creep over him a cloudy consciousness of often recurring confusion in his head. He would unaccountably lose, sometimes whole hours, sometimes a whole day and night. Once, his remembrance stopped as he sat at the head of the dinner table, and was blank until daybreak. Another time, it stopped as he was beating time to their singing, and went on again, when he and his partner were walking in the courtyard by the light of the moon, half the night later. He asked Vendale, always full of consideration, work, and help, how this was. Vendale only replied, "You have not been quite well, that's all." He looked for explanation into the faces of his people. "But they would put it off with, 'Glad to see you looking so much better, sir,' or 'Hope you're doing nicely now, sir,' in which was no information at all." At length, when the partnership was but 5 months old, Walter Wilding took to his bed, and his housekeeper became his nurse. "Lying here, perhaps you will not mind my calling you Sally, Mrs. Goldstraw?" said the poor wine merchant. "It sounds more natural to me, sir, than any other name, and I like it better." "Thank you, Sally. I think, Sally, I must of late have been subject to fits. Is that so, Sally? Don't mind telling me now." "It has happened, sir." "Ah, that is the explanation," he quietly remarked. "Mr. Obenreizer, Sally, talks of the world being so small that it is not strange how often the same people come together, and come together at various places, and in various stages of life. But it does seem strange, Sally, that I should, as I may say, come round to the Foundling to die." He extended his hand to her, and she gently took it. "You are not going to die, dear Mr. Wilding." "So Mr. Bintrey said, but I think he was wrong. The old child feeling is coming back upon me, Sally. The old hush and rest, as I used to fall asleep." After an interval he said, in a placid voice, "Please kiss me, nurse," and, it was evident, believed himself to be lying in the old dormitory. As she had been used to bend over the fatherless and motherless children, Sally bent over the fatherless and motherless man, and put Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.